Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today with me, I have Jonathan Endy of Seamless Docs coming to us from New York. How's your day going, Jonathan?
Doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, glad you could be here. So is it springtime yet in New York, or are you still in the throes of winter?
Yeah, I guess technically it's springtime, being that it's April, yet unfortunately it still requires a winter jacket, so I'm not sure what you call that.
Awesome. Where are you guys actually located? Are you in Manhattan proper, or somewhere outside?
Yep, we're down in Soho. We have some cool offices down here, just in downtown Manhattan.
Cool. Are you a native New Yorker? Or did you move there?
Just over the bridge. I grew up in northern Jersey. Spent a little time, went to school down in Emory in Atlanta. Spent some time in Florida. But yeah, I'm quite the New Yorker, I guess, at this point.
You feel like a New Yorker. That's good. Awesome. So Seamless Docs. What is Seamless Docs? And what do you guys do? How did you start this business?
Sure. So starting from the beginning, it was, almost 5 or 6 years ago now, I was doing some paper processing. I was doing a lot of stuff where attorneys would actually outsource their paperwork to me, doing paralegal outsourcing. The initial goal was actually maybe building a TurboTax for tax relief, and just kind of had this longer epiphany, which is like, why are we still filling out, as I like to call them, dumb PDFs, right? That aren't smart, they ask you 100 questions, maybe 20 are pertinent to you. And that was kind of the aha moment where we're like, okay, great, let's build a tool that allows you to build web forms and have them populate a PDF. It was a little bit of a journey for the first 2 years, and ultimately we ended up focusing exclusively on governments, and that kind of brings us to what we do today. So today, as I mentioned, we work only with governments, mostly on the state and local level, to help them take their existing PDF and form processes. So when you go to that government website, you have to download that dog application. Now we basically let them take that PDF, upload it to our platform, and in just seconds, we turn it into a beautiful online version. So now it can be completed from any device. You can add attachments, you can even add payments or calculations. You can add e-signature. And when you click submit, not only does it automatically build a database of that information, but we actually give you tools for both the government and citizens and staff to be able to collaborate and automate the process thereafter.
Interesting. Yeah. So what made you, because I remember we spoke a couple years ago when I was first launching Foundersuite. We have a collection of startup docs, and we talked about a few ways of working together. But what made you pivot onto the government, or focus on the government? What was the
epiphany? Yeah, that's a great question. And I think also look at an important lesson in the context of raising money. I mean, I think ultimately what it comes down to is, what are you going to be the best at? I think initially we kind of struggled to find our product market fit, who was our perfect customer, really where our value was. And I think, you know, when it came down to it, our tool had a lot of features that we ended up finding ourselves fighting with, like maybe a WooFoo, or fighting with a simple DocuSign, when ultimately we actually were able to provide a lot more value. Yet it was just finding that appropriate use case. Mm. And when we found government, it wasn't just a great use case of our product, it was a really great showcase. And it allowed us to do things that the other tools could not. And then what's really great then is that after we went through Code for America, which was an accelerator program, I like to say that's where I fell in love with government. That's really where I just fell in love with this social mission of just really helping government and kind of debunking this myth that, you know, of the government worker, and actually finding, wow, they're incredibly passionate and incredible public servants. And it just really got inspired. And then since then, I mean, for the past now almost 2.5-3 years, because we've been focusing on government, we really built out an extensive feature set and built a deeper product than anyone else necessarily can accommodate. So we've kind of been a league of our own, and now we're essentially, I like to say that, you know, we are the absolute best at helping governments, you know, take their PDFs and go paperless.
Yeah, that's interesting. You don't have to answer this question, but has Adobe come sniffing around to acquire you guys yet?
So we've been lucky enough because of our focus that, you know, we've had some people knock on our door, but again, we're just really passionate about what we're doing. And as you know, or as I guess one of the reasons for this podcast is, we just recently closed about a $7.5 million additional round. That brings our total funding to just under $19 million. So we're just really excited to be able to like double down and really go all in on government. And the majority of that fund is going to be going towards really just reinvesting into our product so we can build a product not just to help government be able to process their existing forms in PDF, but really build what hopefully will be the infrastructure or part of the infrastructure of the future of government.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been having a few discussions, you know, given what we do with our tools for founders. We've been talking to like urban.us, which is kind of we're talking to a handful of new funds that are kind of focused on government and cities and stuff like that. It's kind of an interesting space for sure.
Yeah. So funny enough, both, you know, the GovTech Fund is one, UrbanUS is another one, 1776. And funny enough, I think we were probably all three of theirs first investments. I think for GovTech, when GovTech wrote us their first check, I don't think they actually didn't have a fund yet. And then also for UrbanUS, Sean, I mean, I remember talking to Sean, and Sean wrote a, I think we were actually their first investment, or he committed, again, same thing, before having a fund. So,
really?
You know, I think, as I like to say, we were, when we started first selling to government, it was just called selling to government.
Yeah.
You know, we like to consider ourselves one of the pioneers in the GovTech space. And, you know, we've personally, and me included, we really debunked a lot of the myths about what is it like to work with government, such as, oh, it's a long time. Oh, it's slow to move. Oh, they're not looking for innovation. And, you know, I think now, you know, a couple of years later, only having hundreds and hundreds of governments, we have clients in every state across the, from the largest governments in the country to large states to small towns in Idaho. I mean, you know, we've been able to debunk that myth and prove out that, wow, the government is ready for innovation. They are ready for the cloud. They are ready to go online. And actually, even more so than that, they're excited about it.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, fantastic. So let's talk about fundraising, and I want to, you know, hear what it's like to pitch a government focused product to VCs. But let's start off with the early days, which I guess is 2012 era. And I'm just looking at my list here. I have Entrepreneurs Roundtable Association, HBS, Harvard Business School alumni, New York Angels. Sounds like you covered a lot of different groups in those early days in your quest for funding. So maybe talk about raising that first, I guess, was it a pre-seed round? I don't even know what you call that, but yeah.
Yeah, well, Angel round. I like to joke around. It all started at Junior's Cheesecake in Times Square. This is a funny little anecdote about, you know, when we first started, it was myself. I had the paper processing business. I spun it out. I had met our CTO, Chachi Kamejo. We were actually down in South Florida at the time. And we kind of knew we needed to take things to the next level. And, you know, just a small funny thing is, we actually posted a listing on GoBigNetwork.com. And if you haven't heard of GoBigNetwork.com, I'm not even sure it exists anymore. This is like pre-AngelList. you know, I remember, I think I got two responses to an ad. One was this, you know, Canadian angel investor, Jamie Dewar. And, you know, the lesson there was, he was like, oh, I'll be in New York actually for a trip with my family. Like, any chance you'll be in town? And I was like, of course I will. And I literally, like, you know, looked on Kayak on my phone and booked a trip to New York one way and texted my buddy, hey, can I sleep on your couch? And then I got to New York, and we were supposed to meet at 2 o'clock on Friday. And he calls me at 1:45. He's like, hey, Jonathan, I'm so sorry, but I'm not going to be able to make it. and keep in mind, like, in retrospect, if he didn't invest, I'm pretty sure the company would not exist anymore. I would have probably, you know, maybe worked my family company or done something else. And he called me, and I don't even think I responded. I think he just heard my heart break out loud. And he's like, you know, if you want, like, I can meet you at midnight. My family's going to see a Broadway show, and we're going to be in Times Square. We love Junior's Cheesecake.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, that's so funny. I'll actually be in the area. And yeah. I ended up, like, meeting him at 12:15 at Junior's Cheesecake, pulled him away. He's like, you've heard of an elevator pitch. This was a cheesecake pitch. I had, until the time it took him, his wife and his two daughters to finish their cheesecake to pitch him. Luckily for me, I speak fast. So I was able to, you know, get the commitment, and it gave us a lot of confidence. I think on Tuesday that week, I don't even think we had doc signed at the time. It was, we ended up wiring $125,000, I believe. And I guess that's ultimately the story there is just, you know, be willing to do whatever it takes and take those chances. I mean, the amount of times in the early days when I went to a networking event, not sure what will happen. And I met someone that ultimately either introduced me to someone or, you know, financing. So in the beginning, it's a lot of just you know, doing whatever it takes. But then with that being said, you asked about early on. Then from there, you know, I think with each step of funding, you kind of, that window gets, you know, smaller. And as you mentioned, you know, I pitched anyone and anyone that would listen in the beginning, early days. I mean, it was hundreds and hundreds of pitches and hundreds of emails, hundreds of unanswered emails. I think from a persistence perspective, that's a huge part of fundraising, is being organized, having your follow-up mechanism. If you email an investor one time and they don't respond, that's okay. Just make sure you set your – and that in itself is – now at the same time, you're also trying to work in your company, which is hard too. But I think that obviously is important, that persistence element. I think I test in the early days a lot of my fundraising exclusively to my persistence and my personality. And I think it was just – I was – passionate. You know, if anyone left, they might not have even understand what the hell I was saying, because especially back then, I was on a lot of Red Bulls and, you know, talking a million miles an hour, and I was really excited about all the features that we were adding.
Yeah.
I remember it used to take me 28 minutes to do a demo and 2 minutes for questions, and now I can do a demo in 2 minutes and spend 28 minutes asking questions. So it's a huge change there. So again, the second lesson there is just persistence and passion. I mean, ultimately, in the beginning days, don't pretend you know everything, because I can almost guarantee things will change. And then as we've evolved, I think that's another thing that's interesting. Even our second round of funding, I think we raised $1 million or so. We, at that point, I mean, it was a little more focused. We were talking a little bit more conceptually about what we were trying to achieve, but we were still pretty broad. And I think what was a little bit scary about going into GovTech was, at the time, especially as I mentioned, you know, three of my investors that are actually probably well known as the more avid, proactive investors in the GovTech space, barely existed, right? So I went from having an investor pool of 200 or 300 unlimited to now having an investor pool that was much smaller. Yet, you know, as we like to say in sales, my conversion rate increased, right? Probably one of the best things that I heard is I was actually sitting in Code for America with Tim O'Reilly and Jen Palka, and I was giving a demo of our early product, and he literally was looking at the ceiling panels. He was so bored, I think. And I look at him, I said, Tim, is everything all right? And he comes down from his trance and he says, Jonathan, I don't believe you're gonna beat Adobe. He goes, but I do believe you can be the best, you know, government form builder. He goes, who's the first person to fly transatlantic? And I said, I thought about it, I said, Charles Lindbergh. He goes, who's the second person? I don't know. Who's the first woman to fly transatlantic? Said Amelia Earhart. And it was just incredible. I literally had this enormous light bulb, not just go off, but explode, because it was just interesting. If you can't be number one in your category, make up your own category. And that's absolutely what Seamus Docs did. And I think from then, instead of me, you know, telling people and begging or trying to persuade them as why we were different than DocuSign, why we were different, you know, all of a sudden when we focused on government, our pitch became so much more concise. Whenever my pitch, it was very obvious who I was selling to, how much I was selling it for, and what the value was. And although you're right, I absolutely excluded some people from those discussions, our conversion rate, it was a lot more obvious. And by the way, everything became easier. Building product became easier, messaging became easier, and fundraising became easier.
Yeah, very interesting. That makes a lot of sense. I love that quote. I wrote it down here. If you can't be number one in the category, make up your own category. That's
absolutely
fantastic.
Yeah, marketing 101.
Yeah, I totally understand, and I like that focus thing too. It makes everything easier too. We had to pivot ourselves. I think we talked last, you and I last talked about 2 or 3 years ago when we were trying to do this broad suite of tools for founders, and then we focused in on just fundraising tools and investor relations, and it's made everything easier, better, more focused, more clear. Yeah, so I love the focus concept too. Awesome. Okay, so let's see. So maybe just touch on, if you recall, I know it was a few years ago, but what was it like pitching New York Angels, right? If you were maybe advising a younger New York founder who's interested in approaching some of these New York Angel groups, any tips on that? What was that process like?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Harvard Business School Angels, New York Angels. I mean, ultimately, I think the early tip there, I have a good tip and then a precautionary tip in that regard. You know, it's ultimately when you're pitching groups of angels, you know, again, it's the same thing. You're not going to appease all of them. You know, New York Angels had a broad spectrum of investors. Some had media backgrounds, some had legal backgrounds, you know, some had software backgrounds and some government backgrounds, you know, et cetera. And I think ultimately, there's this notion where you're trying to appease everyone. And, you know, I think just don't ever forget the power of no. I look back now and it was like every question that was asked to me by the audience after a pitch, I was like, can you, I remember there's still to this day, there was one investor. He was like, you got to be offline. You have to have offline access to your forms. And I remember us being like, okay, great. Like that's definitely something, but like right now our roadmap, like that's going to take us some time. And I ultimately think he ended up not investing. And I actually think, and he called me later, I ran into him and he actually said he regretted it. But I mean, I think that was one thing where.
Don't you love that just, though? Don't you love that when you get that investor who told you no?
That's why I do this actually, I think. Just prove people wrong. All the naysayers. But I mean, but ultimately, and keep in mind, you know, there were a lot of people that thought I was crazy when I started doing GovTech. Investors included. And, you know, I think having that commission and now everyone's like, oh, it seems so obvious. You know, there is this definitely leap of faith, but ultimately, to continue with that point, it's just, you don't have to appease every person in that angel investor group. And ultimately, just stand with the conviction and be sure of what you want. Just because an investor asks a question about your product does not mean you should change your product roadmap based on that. But also listen. And the second thing from a cautionary matter is keep in mind, ask them how they invest. You know, a lot of times angel groups can negotiate as a group but participate individually, which, by the way, is a little bit of a cart and a horse kind of problem.
Yeah.
Because ultimately they'll say, oh, well, if you guys, we'll give you $250,000, but we want this term, this term, and this term. Keep in mind, angel investors are a little bit more investor-friendly terms versus like a lot of VCs now have kind of gone to like more middle of the road. So just be careful there because just because they say, oh, we think we'll invest 200K does not necessarily mean they're going to invest 200K. I had probably two or three situations in our early stages where I was promised X dollars and they negotiate on those terms. And then when it came down to it, I only got 80% or 70% of the actual funds that we were discussing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, good stuff. Would you advise then to maybe oversubscribe knowing that 20% or something like that is going to drop out or not materialize, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, oversubscribing, it's like it's one of the greatest tools you have as a founder. I mean, I tell CEOs all the time and I ask them how much money and then I ask them why. I'm always surprised they don't have an answer. There's a big difference in raising $250,000 to $500,000 to $1 million to $1.5 million and so forth. And, you know, ultimately, especially early on, I encourage founders, if you want to raise $750,000, if you think you need $750,000, that'd be great, but you could do $500,000, raise $500,000, be oversubscribed. You have a lot more power in oversubscription than you do in $750,000. And don't underestimate the power of momentum when you're doing a fundraising round.
Yeah, for sure. Did you have momentum when you were raising? Let's say that, I guess it's the 1.25 million, 1.25 million round with 1776 GovTech, Rose Paul. What was that round like? Did you have some pretty good momentum there? You had focused in on GovTech. Kind of tell us about that environment.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately it's just about messaging. And I think that's something I've definitely understand a little bit better now is I will definitely say that as you get that momentum, it just becomes easier and you can start making rules at all, you know. You know, if you don't, so I think from a mentor perspective, you have to kind of create that. I mean, that's part of the art of the fundraise is that finesse. Our last round, I think we initially were going to raise anywhere between 5 and 7 million. And I think the spoiler here, I think you know, it raised 7.5. So, you know, how I was able to do that was, you know, basically at a certain point, I was talking to a lot of people and I was able to, you know, let them know, hey, by the way, like this person is actually thinking about investing $1 million and, you know, I need to know ASAP, and then by building that momentum, and then all I had a couple of existing investors that were going to invest, you know, 500 and came over 750, and as I was able to communicate that appropriately and tactfully, I was able to kind of create that momentum and let them know, well, hold on, these guys are doubling down on their investor, and they know you. Well, I want to do that too, and I think that's definitely an interesting element of, again, as I mentioned, is finesse. When it comes to these fundraising rounds and how to structure that. And also, by the way, like, don't be afraid to ask, like, are you in or are you out? Because don't underestimate the value of your own time. A lot of investors want to be the last ones in and ultimately, which I do understand, but just don't underestimate the power of being like, are you in? Yes or no, and having that conviction. Because I think that also, as I've grown into my fundraising rounds, in the beginning, I was almost nervous to ask. It was like, oh, well, let me know. And now I'm like, okay, great, guys. Like, I have $750,000 left in the round. I would like to know, you know, as soon as possible. I have some other people involved interested. How much are you going to invest, and when can I get a commitment? And then also, by the way, this is something that happens in sales with government too, is understanding process. An angel investor might not have a process. It might just be like signing a check. An angel fund might have a process where they have a committee that you need to invest in. A venture fund might have an investor committee that you need to present to, or it might take some additional time. So just understanding that. New York State is one of our investors, and you know, obviously there's a process behind that, and just being respectful of that and asking up front, what does that look like to better, so you can better plan your own financing.
Yeah, no, that's a good, I like that. What's understanding the process of your, of who you're pitching.
Yeah, and by the way, I mean, I start my conversations with VCs and I ask them what size, before they even get to the pitch, like, hey, they usually ask, do you have any questions? I said, yes, I would love to understand some of your thesis. Like, do you guys normally lead? Are you interested in co-investing, or do you participate in rounds individually? What size check do you normally like to write? And I think also that is something that is, just from a maturity perspective, I think you'll actually get a lot of credit for when doing those early read and asking them and saying, because you need a soft start for something, right? If you don't ask those questions, you know, when you're taking your time to pitch, this is how I always think about any call at this point, is, you know, I'm willing to give information, and that's a value that I'm being able, but like, what information am I being able to get, and what is your call to action? And by the way, the call to action on these calls is not to get them to sign a check normally. It's to go to the next step.
Sure.
So every call, I want to know approximately what is their process, what size check range do they write, and then I also want to understand what's the next step. Is it a committee meeting? Is there additional documentation that they need? You know, what are the next steps? And that's a clear plan. So I at least have a very clear plan of what's the next process in the step.
Yeah, good. I want to go back to rewind it just a minute here when you're saying, you know, you are not shy anymore about asking, are you in? I guess what. When do you ask that? Do you ask it after you've already got a pretty good number of commitments? I mean, I find it's, you know, once you've sort of have more than half the round committed, it's much easier to do that. But those early days, it's harder to.
Yeah,
sort of,
so I do want to clarify. I mean, ultimately, the are you in conversation only happens once you have a lead and you have a round shaped up. Uh-huh. And you ultimately know how that is. So before then, obviously, you're not asking those questions. I mean, actually, to the contrary, the reason why you're asking a lot of these investors initially is, are you interested? Is if you know they're not a lead, then you're not asking them, are they in? And you know, I think even a lot of times I've used that to my benefit, where I know they're not a lead, and actually that's what happened with Motorola. Motorola came and approached us and said, are you interested in an investment? And I kept on telling them, sorry, you know, we don't have a lead. I'll get back to you when I have a lead.
Yeah.
And eventually they said, we'll lead. So that was like a. But I mean, I think even just understanding who's going to lead, and then once you get that done, once you have a round, then it's being, again, just understand the process. If you know that you have a committee, then it doesn't make, you know, if you're talking to an analyst, then don't ask them if they're in, obviously. But I think you can ask them for next steps and when is that appropriate. And then at that point, once the round really starts coming together and you have your lead and you need to fill it in, ask them, hey, what are next steps? And they're like, oh, we're in the decision-making process. Okay, great. Like, you know, how much time do you need? Like, what's the process? When should I follow up? And then, again, obviously, when appropriate, don't be shy.
Yeah, good. Let me ask about a couple of your investors. Like, 1776, they're an interesting one. I think of them as sort of a co-working space or an incubator. But I guess they have a GovTech fund as well? Or what are they all about?
They have a separate fund. I mean, 776 has kind of morphed a little bit over the years. Again, I think I first met them maybe 4-ish years ago. Again, I think I was one of their early investments, and I'm pretty sure I'm their largest position up until now. You know, I think for them, they were a little bit of both. They had a fund, they had an accelerator program or an incubator, and then they had the co-working space. They were a little bit of a hybrid. But I think overall, I mean, GovTech, UrbanUS, there's a lot of education that's happened over the past couple of years where, again, if I had asked you 3 years ago, Nathan, about GovTech, you'd be like, what's GovTech? And now I think it's actually a pretty burgeoning space, and you're seeing more and more funds. Now you're seeing guys like Sequoia, guys like Andreessen, guys like Emerson Collective that are getting and putting in large money in rounds. You know, we've been lucky. I mean, we've raised, again, $20 million, so it puts us in a unique class. You know, I would say probably in GovTech, maybe there's 20 or so companies that have that have raised over $10 million even. But there are companies that have raised over 100. One of our cohorts, Mark 43, within the GovTech Fund, I think just closed around at $45 million, I think bringing the funds almost $100 million. OpenGov, same thing. So this is no longer like a nascent sector anymore. This is a burgeoning, growing, and I think one of the largest opportunities in any space.
You just made me think about something when you said OpenGov. Do you remember, I don't know how old you are, but do you remember the movie Startup.com with GovWorks? It profiled GovWorks in Web 1.0, and that was, classic movie.
So Sean, I know you know Sean from Urbanus now. So Sean was actually one of the early employees and high-up employees. He led M&A for GovWorks. So it's funny, when I first met him, he's like, "You are what GovWorks should have built." And I was like, "Yes, that is true." And they were just too early. But absolutely, I mean, I think that even then, that was something that was like, was this really big idea, and they spent, I think, $100 million, and who knows what happened to it ultimately. But, you know, I think now what our goal is that, you know, my CTO was at Google for 10 years, right? My director of operations, you know, went to Harvard and MBA from Michigan. I mean, I think we have people that from all these really amazing teams that have come on, and our goal is, how do we go and take what historically is like a Code for America project or a nonprofit? How do we apply? We're not just a good GovTech business, we're a great business. And then how do I be able to communicate that to investors? And I think ultimately, when you think about my business is, not only do I sell to governments, and I've proven out that our sales cycles are reasonable, or traditional enterprise sales cycle, I've been able to grow we have 125% revenue renewal rate, which is about as good as it gets in any space, right? We have a highly engaged customer base that is using us to do their job every day. I mean, I think that doesn't matter what space I'm in. I think that's an exciting business. And I think ultimately the fact that, you know, we've been able to double down and engage. And I think the biggest thing here, the last thing I will say is it clear your product market fit? And I think I feel so lucky that every day our governments are asking us, what about like this new features? And I am no longer controlling what that roadmap looks like. Our customers are, which is always an exciting place to be as a startup.
Yeah. No, that's great. That's great. So I was going to ask, I think you've kind of addressed it, but if this new GovTech funding environment is pretty new, right? I mean, all these funds are less than 10 years old or maybe even younger. Is there enough money to raise your next round? I think you kind of already addressed that by mentioning like Sequoia and others are maybe getting into the space. But the question was basically, is there a deep enough funding pool to continue growing, you know, at 125% revenue growth rate?
Absolutely. I mean, now it's funny. Now, I think I had an email a week from some investor, like really excited about what we're doing and wanted to talk. And by the way, I don't respond to any of them at this point. I mean, I think right now we're just really head down and building an amazing product and building a great business. I think that's the number one as a founder, especially once you close, you know, there's so much bandwidth that is consumed with these fundraising cycles. And ultimately at this point, we're just heads down. We want to build the best freaking product on the planet to help our governments. We're incredibly passionate about it. We're absolutely committed to that mission. And then also on the business side of things, yes, we have great business economics. And again, as I mentioned, we're not just a great GovTech business; we're a great business. So it doesn't necessarily matter anymore.
Sure.
You know, we've proven the product market fit. We've proven our engagement. We've proven the worth. And I think it's undeniably a large space as well. So
I want to riff off that a little bit. You mentioned now your head's down, you're not responding to these inbound inquiries. There's kind of two schools in thought, right? Like, should the CEO be always fundraising, even in between rounds? Or I guess, would you advocate for just raise the money, go heads down until you're trying to pop back up and raise some more, you know, kind of?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately a lot of venture capital is about relationships, right? And I think ultimately, you know, and it's, you have a certain reputation, I think you obviously want to be fostering those. But yeah, at the same time, if you allow those distractions, there'll always be a distraction. And I think, you know, keep in mind, a lot of times these investor calls are very much so information collection and just keeping their tabs on you. And I think ultimately, you know, throughout the years, I mean, I think when appropriate, I mean, I've kind of, you know, made relationships and I think, and I keep in touch again when appropriate and share news when appropriate outbound. But I think just being careful of not making too much distraction. I mean, again, we've raised many rounds. So obviously, I haven't been entirely heads down. But even this last round was majority in terms of relationships. Every single one of our existing investors or that had the capacity to invest in it. And as I mentioned, double down even more than their pro rata. And I think that's something that I think, I don't know if you can be any more flattered as a founder. The fact that because these are people that are working with you and have seen you through the hard times and the great times. So I think that's something that don't underestimate relationships. And that's something where I think I've been able to balance that balance between like not being overly networking, but at the same time maintaining those existing relationships is something that I think I've done a decent job balancing on.
Yeah. Good. Do you send a newsletter to all those folks that are maybe prospective or inbound folks? Do you do anything like that?
I don't personally. I know some people do. Again, I think there was a recent article I was reading from another founder how, you know, it's like people want what they is desired and that kind of unknown. And I think that ultimately by doing that, it almost seems like you're sharing too much. And I think also there's an element now with I have a responsibility that we have a lot of private things. Our revenues are private, like or some of the we have a really cool project working on now that can stealth that like I don't necessarily want like everyone knowing and forwarding an email. Mm. To be honest, even our early investors, we don't necessarily provide the most often updates. I mean, we have our board meetings. I have great relationships with my mentors and my board. And I think that's obviously really important. But obviously it's sending a newsletter, I don't know if I'd recommend it seems a little too like not unique. We've got again, investors kind of want to feel like, oh, this is a deal I have the opportunity for and things like that.
Interesting. So. Yeah. Kind of, keeping the mystery around it. That's interesting. All right. This is awesome. So last question here, you know, what mistakes have you made? What advice would you give? What's kind of the core learnings you've learned from this 5 years plus of fundraising and building your business?
Yeah, I mean, mistakes I definitely made in all of them. I mean, I think starting with the first one, where it also took us 2.5 years to focus, find your focus early. If you think about any company, Facebook, Uber, they started with a small subset, and now they've actually grown to be much larger. Uber was black cars in San Francisco. Facebook was university student, Ivy League university student networking. Focus. Second one is don't worry about the features. Sell the concept, sell the vision of what you're creating. But also make sure they understand how you're going to execute. Is it clear how you're going to get your first customer and how you're going to make money? Number three, I would say, is ultimately, you know, it's just persistence and focus. And I think the combination of those two and just passion. I mean, at the end of the day, is this something that you want to be doing 5 years from now? I mean, for me, I think I'm lucky in a way. I mean, we stumbled into our passion almost accidentally. People say, oh, my God, like, how'd you get into government? And I was like, by accident. We were really lucky. I guess, as I mentioned, I fell in love with government, and I couldn't feel more lucky/blessed to get to come into work and work on this incredible social mission. But just make sure that, like, you know, is this something you want to be doing 5 years from now? And making sure you fall in love with the purpose and not the love with just the idea. I think other than that, it's a roller coaster for sure, and I think also as it grows, by the way, like you still have your downs. It's just actually the highs get higher and the lows get lower, and I think ultimately, it's a journey I wouldn't substitute for anything. So whoever's listening to this, again, I wish you the best on whatever journey you might be having. The more focused, the easier it is to execute on everything. I wish everyone the best of luck.
Awesome. Good. So if anyone wants to check you out, it's just seamlessdocs.com, right?
Yep.
Any plug you want to make, any call to action, any open job recs you're trying to fill for, or anything you want to plug at all?
Oh, wow. Thanks. Normally I have to do that myself. I don't get the offer. I'm absolutely worried. I mean, if you're passionate about changing the way government works, we're hiring for pretty much any position there is: sales, success, engineering, marketing, operations, I mean, everything. We're really excited. I mean, I think we had like 8 people starting new yesterday, and we're growing pretty fast. If you're a government listening, definitely come check us out, or you know someone in government, send them over to Seamless Docs and say, hey, I think this is interesting. I think it's check it out. We couldn't be more excited about where we are right now. Thank
Perfect.
You.
Are all your jobs in New York, just for anyone actually interested in that? Is it all New York, or are you guys spread around?
Yes, so we have DC offices in San Francisco, DC, Miami. And technically, I mean, we're open. If you're talented and it's something you want to do, we'll make it work.
Very good. All right, Jonathan, this is just wonderful, super fun. I'm going to give a shout out to the Urban US folks. But this is great. Thank you very much, and continued success with Seamless Docs.
Yes, thank you so much. And thank you for all those early supporters that supported me, even though I'm not even sure I necessarily knew what I was doing or who I was selling to. But luckily, we figured it out. And for those of you that didn't support us, hopefully we'll see you from the top.
Prove you wrong. Yeah, it's the good stuff.
Yeah.
All right, sir. Thank you.